I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For the 1st of March, I'm really excited that we can begin with someone who's not been on the morning show in quite some time, a force of nature that I know many of you know, Dr. Michelle Hancock, formerly superintendent of the Kenosha Station as well. And I thought it would be nice to spend a few minutes talking with Dr. Hancock about the work that she does at Carthage around really important issues of inclusion and diversity, and what she sees as progress already made, and maybe areas in which there is a lot of work yet to be done, including work on Carthage's comprehensive anti-racism plan. Dr. Michelle Hancock, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Nice to see your smiling face. We are recording this actually on Monday morning. So first of all, it probably would be helpful to learn a little bit more about the responsibilities you have in this intriguing position as Vice President of College Culture for Inclusion. What is
organizations, especially higher education organizations, we tend to work in silos. We have faculty here, we have staff here, we have students somewhere in the middle. And so really the goal is to coordinate our work in a more efficient and truly feels a sense of belonging and can be successful in 4 years in graduating from the college.
How much of what you have and the college has in terms of goals, how much of those goals revolve around hard and fast numbers, such as, for instance, retention rates, graduation rates, that kind of things? I mean, success that can be measured numerically versus other kinds of success or progress that is not as easily measured, but some would argue is every bit as perhaps even more important. How do you weigh those different kinds of success in the work that you do?
Well, in the work that I do, I think both are extremely important. You're talking about quantitative and qualitative data that we collect. Now, we have a lot of that at Carthage, and we have a lot of quantitative data, and we do climate surveys. So we have the information. But I will tell you that what I found most useful so far in my role is really connecting with the students and finding out their stories and using that qualitative data. It's extremely important. We have a equity dashboard, we have a scorecard rather, that we know where we want to be headed, what we need to do. Qualitative data lets us know that we're not doing as well, we're not hitting some of our retention targets as well as we would like. So what does that mean in terms of what do we know about the student experience? What are they sharing with us that can let us know that we can make better decisions to make sure that every student feels that they can be successful at Carthage, regardless of their sexual orientation, regardless of their race, ethnicity, their religious beliefs, their political beliefs.
Was this position already in existence when you came aboard, or are you, in a sense, in on the ground floor of this particular initiative?
I'm in on the ground floor in terms of having someone at the executive level that is at the table, having the conversations at that level. But we've always had like a director of equity and inclusion for the past, since I've been here, the past 7 to 8 years. And that initially started as a part-time position with Professor Basiglia, and then it transferred to me briefly, because you know, in smaller colleges, we wear multiple hats. And so we might be a professor, but we might be a director also. But this is the first time that they've had a position that is defined this way. At the executive level.
And time. And of course, at the high school level as well, there are concerns about improved collegiate level. Does it fundamentally differ, or by and large, is it very much the same kind of work going about achieving these goals in the same way, but just in a different setting? How different does this work feel at Carthage?
That's an excellent question. I don't know for me if it feels different, because after so many decades in being in education, and this has been my primary focus around equity and around how do we make sure that all students feel that they can get a really great education, I would say that for me, the work just continues. It's ongoing. So it never stops. So when I think about how I'm approaching it, it's the same, because I'm reviewing what Carthage, or what I did as a superintendent, what were we offering the students? How did we know that we were really meeting the challenges of students? And how did we review what I think of as equity assets in any organization? And then, like, for me, as a superintendent, it was all about a theory of action. What was the belief systems of the organization? What is the culture of the organization? And how do we think about that? And what theory of action do we put into place? It's the same process mentally for me in terms of this role. Like, how do I bring all the different groups together with a common focus on one thing? And that one thing that I keep repeating over and over: every student should have a right to a quality education. So what does that look like? What does that feel like for the faculty, for the staff, for the students? And how do we improve? What are the areas in which we want to improve? So I don't see it that different.
Mm-hmm. So in your time at Carthage, and maybe I should just pause and ask how long it's been. And I think one of the reasons why I'm so foggy on that is thanks to COVID. I don't mean COVID fog, but because COVID just kind of interrupted so many kind of time frames and timelines, it's kind of hard to remember. And I suspect COVID maybe was a complication for you and your colleagues in terms of working on some of this. But how long have you been at Carthage, and how would you trace what has occurred thus far?
Well, I've been at Carthage for approximately almost 8 years now, Greg. And what I think that Carthage has done, I've seen change within those 8 years, change for the better. We now have a diverse perspectives curriculum that we've looked at general education framework, and teams of educators and professors have really, we voted to change what we were doing at that gen ed, general education level. We've fundraised like phenomenal for DEI work. We have so much tremendous support from people, alumni that I didn't see when I first came in, that now there is a target focus on ensuring that we have the allocated resources we need to move forward with this work. I think that's really big, because you can't really make change without having resources. And that's human resources as well as staff and the students that want to continue this journey in a way that shows that we can do it, that we can ensure that Carthage is viewed as a stellar, institution that truly, where regardless of where you come from or how you love or where you live, your zip code is in my office. We are expanding the roles. We are going to have more people in positions here that has been really funded and supported through not only the college, but through the alumni. So I'm just real thrilled about what is going to happen moving forward. And knowing that what we've done in the past so far has set the stage for that. We have our DEI strategic plan that's going to be modified, and of that, we are collaborating in a way that we want to ensure that whatever policies, practices that are getting and procedures that are getting in the way of every student feeling successful, we're forming those ad hoc and task committees throughout the college that are taking specific elements of challenges that we see within our system and making those changes. And that takes time, and we're doing it, though. We're moving in that direction, and I feel really good about it.
Very good. I think the implication of what you're saying, or what I'm inferring, is that we maybe have not seen yet much in the way of numerical change,
right?
Kind of quantitative, and that is something you expect to see now in the next few years. Is that fair to say?
That is very fair to say. I feel that with President Swallow and making the decision to do this, but it's also, I believe, that when President Swallow came out with his anti-racism plan of action and what he wanted to have happen there, I just think that that was critical in making a public statement that we are committed to this work.
I wanted to ask you specifically about the anti-racism plan and what your role specifically has been in sort of in guiding the college through that.
Mm-hmm. So, well, first of all, I think that one of the things that we still have to understand, and, you know, all across the country, this term anti-racism, we have to understand, really was him looking at it through an active process of identifying and challenging and confronting racism. And so what we're doing right now in my role is to confront the systems, the organizational structures, the policies, practice, behaviors, attitudes, all of that, Greg, that comes into play to really redistribute power in an effort to foster equitable outcomes. We need to make sure an equitable outcomes really is viewed through our student retention and graduation rates. We know that that's part of it, but also the student experience is another part of that. So I really believe that President Swallow making that statement truly was a jumpstart point for us going a little bit deeper into the work.
Of course, Carthage is not exactly an island unto itself when it comes to a lot of these issues. They are playing out on the national scene, on the national landscape. I wonder, as somebody who is deeply and energetically engaged in this work, what your impressions are about the state of race relations in the United States right now, and where do you see us going?
Clearly, what I see right now is a country divided, and I believe that higher education institutions, like any institutions, we are a microcosm of the larger society. So I do stand and know that there is this opportunity to continue to confront institutional structuralized racism. It's been here, it's been in existence, it's rearing its head in a way that I have hoped that we were at a better place. We have to have is an internal belief that things can be better, and things can be better through the actions of many different people. So at Carthage, what I find hopeful, that even in spite of where the country is right now, there are always pockets of real authentic work being done to challenge it and to improve it. And it's an ongoing process. It never stops. I don't know if, Greg, I will ever see a day where we can say that the structures of racism have been wiped away. But I do believe that history has a strange way of repeating itself, you know? And so we go through these cycles of struggle. And so sometimes the struggles are bigger at times than at other times. Right now, I feel that we are in a big struggle nationally, you know, and locally. But I also feel that it's institutions like Carthage and many other higher education institutions are really not backing down from moving an agenda to better support young people.
Once upon a time, at least the primary face of racism was something really overt and unmistakable. And it was, among other things, burning crosses on people's lawns and that kind of thing. I mean, terrible and terrifying. Racism doesn't still exist in some places, but mostly we're talking about a different face of racism that, in a sense, is much more subtle, and yet its effects are profound. And I should think the way that we deal with that is different, because, in effect, we have a lot of work to do when it comes to just recognizing it in the first place, whether in ourselves or in others or in systems. What do you suggest we do about that?
Well, see, and you are absolutely correct, but this is what I say intentional. We've had systems of structural racism that has never gone away. I think what has happened now that wasn't before when we saw the overt, now we're seeing where people are becoming educated about the insidious structural racism that exists. People are understanding about redlining. They're understanding about the policies and the practices that are put into place that has always impacted age bracket. I think many of us now are more aware, and with that awareness, I think that really leads to action. You know, you have this first phase of your own self-awareness. And Carthage, we have done a great job of offering you to recognize that we are all. Institutions start looking at their own policies and practices that literally doesn't provide access and opportunity for all, then you know we're getting there, that we're slowly but surely getting there. And the battle will always be there, because as you can see through our judicial system, through our laws and everything, what people are trying to create with voting. Let's just take voting, for example. And there's always been this battle for voting. Now you have states putting in a lot of different laws that really will impact people in very negative ways in their ability to vote. But I firmly believe that no matter what anyone tries to put in place, America has shown that we have always pushed back, and we push back in appropriate ways to bring about effective change. And like I told you, I'm going to say this again, it is cyclical in the world. Things happen and they come back around, come back in a different way, different form. But we are, I believe in the human spirit. I believe that human beings clearly want a better world. And so that's the continuous battle.
Dr. Michelle Hancock, Vice President of College Culture for Inclusion at Carthage, as well as a professor in the Education Department. Dr. Hancock, it's always a pleasure to speak with you, and I appreciate your time, and I appreciate the good work you're doing at Carthage. Thank you so much for being part of the morning show today, and best wishes.
And thank you for having me. I really appreciate you asking me to come on.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. And now an interview that comes from the Morning Show archive.
We're going to be talking for the next few minutes on the Morning Show about a very thought-provoking book, which examines the relationship between white America and black America and the way in which cultural sharing has gone on in some really perhaps somewhat surprising and unexpected ways, and the way in which, in particular, the thing but the burden, what white people are taking from black culture. It is actually a collection of essays that approach this thought from various perspectives, and the book is edited by Greg Tate, who is a longtime staff writer at The Village Voice and has a number of literary works to his credit and some musical credits as well as the musical director of the well-known music ensemble Burnt Sugar. And we have Greg Tate for a few minutes to talk with us about this book called Everything But the Burden. Greg hey. Tate, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You say in the introduction that this is admittedly a peculiar book about a peculiar fascination. Tell us why you were moved to say such a thing about your own book and about the topic it explores.
Well, the origins of the book are kind of peculiar in that the project was actually brought to me by two editors at Broadway, who were both white, who were both fascinated by the emergence of Eminem as a pop culture icon, and also by R&B had on the Rolling Stones and the Beatles and Eric Clapton and so forth. So, you know, what we wanted to look at was kind of how, you know, this whole kind of attraction-repulsion effect that's going on in terms of, you know, the black racial hatred and bestial treatment and the whole lot of it.
That's, what, of course, one of the points which I think is particularly interesting. When someone comes along and emulates certain cultural attributes,
right,
of the black community, do you feel, and the writers who share their thoughts in this book, do you feel that that is being done by people that otherwise feel, as you say, scornfully towards blacks, or isn't it being done by whites who happen not to feel that way?
Well, I think that it's one of those things that you look at in a multidimensional kind of way, because, you know, I mean, if people hadn't unearthed some of, say, Elvis Presley's, you know, somewhat racially inflammatory comments, you know, in his history, I don't think that, you know, there would have been quite the ire that some people feel towards Elvis Presley, because, in fact, when he first was heard on the radio, he was played on black stations, and a lot of black people thought he was black and were surprised when he showed up at their, you know, in their town theaters to find out that, oh, this is a white guy. You know what I mean? But, I mean, black audiences have always embraced white artists who they felt were really, you know, honoring, you know, their influence, in a sense, by bringing their art, you know, kind of white inheritance had.
In your introduction, you quote someone, I can't remember now who it is, who posed the question, I think some time ago, but maybe you think the question is still worth asking, okay. Why does everyone love black music, but nobody loves black people?
Right.
Who was that who posed that question?
It's actually a performance artist by the name of Roger Guinevere Smith, and he actually did a performance called Huey Newton for PBS that Spike Lee shot, you know, where he told the Huey Newton story, but in an earlier work, he had posed that question, and it always stuck with me because I think it's
right. Now, one of the things I want to try to get a better handle of, because I have read the book to some extent, but not really digested it to the extent that I want to, are your various writers whose essays are collected here, do they buy in a perspective of resentment, or are they writing about others in the black community who resent this, what's called in some places, white piracy?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, as you go through the book, you see that it takes a lot of kind of left turns and odd angles in terms of looking at it. You know,
that's my sense, yeah.
Yeah, because some people write very personally. There's an incredible memoir in the book by a young writer named Cassandra Lane. It's called Skinned, where, you know, she talks about growing up in Louisiana. And, you know, Cassandra's a young woman, I mean, in her late 20s, you know. So, I mean, the experience she's talking about is really from the late 70s, early 80s. But it's the experience of having white playmates up until a certain point when their parents decided that she wasn't good enough to play with their children anymore. You know what I mean? And, you know, she deals with, like, you know, so that's like one very kind of raw personal response, you know, to the thematic of the book. And then, you know, the other people who look at things in a much more academic kind of fashion, you know, almost. I mean, there's a woman named Renee Green in the book who really looks at the way race is represented in science fiction films, you know, and she spends a lot of time talking about a film with Charlton Heston called The Omega Man.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, yeah, you know, and she talks about also the novels of the black science fiction writer, Octavia Butler, you know, and how she deals with the slave experience in a science fictional kind of context, you know what I mean? But, you know, it's an attempt to really kind of look at this thing as broadly as possible in terms of the African-American response, you know? And so, I mean, writers emotionally are coming from a lot of different places, you know? And, I mean, Carl Hancock Rux's piece on Eminem, on one hand, you think it's maybe coming from this place of resentment, but what he's really talking about is how the need for black people to actually perform a stereotype of black culture is an oppressing thing in and of itself. The fact that black people have adopted this as an option in terms of how to respond to a racist context is a limiting thing in and of itself. So, you know, the writers take you on a lot of journeys in these essays.
Right.
You know, and it definitely take you a lot of places that, you know, I wasn't even expecting to go as an editor.
I suppose one of the parallels that maybe we could draw about this would be that it is perceived by some that taking on a like of black music and adopting certain black fashion styles and so on, and yet not necessarily embracing any blacks as friends, would be a little bit the same as if someone didn't mind their son playing with blacks on a basketball team.
Sure.
But would really have a problem if he tried to bring them home with him, or if one of them wanted to date his daughter or something like that, that somehow that would cross a line. Is that a fair parallel?
I think so. I mean, I think that the mythology and the pathology that's developed around race and America and cultural sharing and so forth, you know, I mean, I think a lot of people, you know, black, white, and otherwise, have a lot of confusion around their identity as Americans because of the way, how racially skewed, you know, this mythology. Well, at the same time, I can turn on the television, you know, and go from channel to channel, and within like 2, 3, 4, 5 seconds, there's going to be, you know, a black iconic figure, a black musical reference, a black stylistic nuance, you know, portrayed there, you know. So you have this peculiar, again, to use that word, impression that's left by people being socially segregated, but then at the same time kind of culturally bombarded, you know, with black. Well, I mean, I think people have such a broad number of responses to the thing. You know, somebody was asking me, you know, how do black people feel about Eminem? And, you know, I couldn't possibly speak for all black people, but, you know, among my friends, I have some people who are pretty politically militant who love Eminem and other people who can't stand it. You know what I mean? And it really just depends on, you know, how open-minded the person is to a certain extent and to what degree, you know, someone is willing to let go of, say, their feelings about racial oppression to accept,
is African-American. I can't think of her name now, but in a conversation with another staffer at the hospital where something has come up and the sense was that this was sort of sparked by maybe latent racism. And the one character who is white says, you know, this was not about race. And this African-American nurse replies, with us, it's always about race.
Right.
It's easy for you to say, but for us, it's always about race. And I suppose that's part of what we're talking about is that mindset that views everything that happens on racial terms.
Well, you know, I mean, it's inevitable. You know what I mean? Because it's, you know, I mean, a Jasper, Texas happens, you know, an Amadou Diallo happens. So, you know, in some senses, you know, that a lot of us kind of drop our guard, and then, you know, these kind of bestial incidents of racial violence occur that have such a pronounced history in terms of racial interaction in American society. But as well, you know, a friend of mine used to say that, you know, to be black in this country is to always affirm something, you know. And what he meant by that was, you know, you have a people who were designated incapable of living with whites and incapable of intellectual development by, you know, one of the founders of the country. I mean, Thomas Jefferson, you know, I mean, who's, you know, some of whose statements on race, I mean, would make, you know, Trent Lott look like a racial progressive.
Yeah.
You know, by comparison.
Right. It's, you know, very, I mean, striking to read, yeah, some of those Jefferson quotations that you include.
You know, without a doubt. I mean, you know, I mean, his racial paranoia was, you know, in some ways beyond comparison.
For one thing, Jefferson seems to have believed that blacks were incapable of profound thought.
Exactly. You know, and this was even in the face of receiving letters from the great mathematician and engineer and architect Benjamin Banneker, and from the great poet and philosopher Phyllis Wheatley, you know, in his own time. You know, I mean, this is someone who, that really were more a reflection of what was going on in his head, you know what I mean? But, I mean, a lot of that has to do, you know, when you know that kind of history, you know what I mean, and you know that, you know, some of the most offensive ideas about race come from people who are educated, highly placed in the society, highly influential in the society as well.
There are 18 essays in this book, and we are treated to all kinds of different takes on this question,
sure,
including a chapter about Eminem, as you said, a chapter,
right,
about pimps, a chapter about thugs. One particularly fascinating essay, I think, talks about Muhammad Ali and George Foreman,
right,
and Norman,
yeah, Tony Green.
Yeah. Yeah, and the contrast, for instance, between Ali and Foreman, and what that says about different essays. What do we learn from drawing those kind of fascinating comparisons?
Well, I think that, you know, I mean, Tony Green, who wrote that essay, is a writer as well as a former athlete, you know, and he read Norman Mailer's White Negro essay early on, and as he says, you know, some of the things that, you know, Mailer, some of the assumptions he makes about black culture in that book are just outrageous, but he almost feels like somebody had to go there just to break the ice in terms of the way white people read black people and black people's effect on white, you know, on white culture, white society, and so forth. You know, but he also goes on to say that he feels that some of Mailer's writing on boxing, you know, came the closest to anything he'd ever read to the experience of being an athlete on the field. You know, so Tony's coming from a place of great appreciation for Mailer. But, you know, if you see the film When We Were Kings, you know, you see Norman Mailer and George Plimpton in the film kind of going back and forth over the psychology of Muhammad Ali and George Foreman. And it's just, it's almost like hysterical to see, you know, these two literary lions trying to probe inside the psyches of these two black men who have pretty much been sent to Africa to beat each other's brains.
Right.
You know what I mean? And finding that for all their powers of erudition and psychoanalysis, they can't figure out either one of these guys, what they're really about.
Yeah, they don't,
you know,
come,
I mean,
particularly,
like,
close.
Yeah, you know what I mean? And, you know, so in a way, Tony's piece is almost like a send-up of watching these two guys kind of tear their hair out, trying to understand these two black athletes. You know, at the same time, you know, he's just talking about how, you know, as a young black man, he identified more with Foreman than with Ali, you know, because he was a stocky kind of guy, you know, and not that fast on his feet. You know, people made assumptions about him as an athlete, too, you know what I mean? And that's, you know, that's kind of typical of the way this book kind of rings changes, you know, in theme and variation, you know, out of the topic.
Right.
You know? And,
We have just a minute or so, but I wanted to get a sense of, did these essays already exist, or did you assemble them?
No, they're, except for the Hilton House piece on Richard Pryor and
yes.
the Mafia Diawara essay about the impact of, soul music on youth in Mali in Africa in the 1970s. They're all original essays.
Very good. And you chose these writers, and
yes.
did you give them their topics, or did you set them free to explore what they wanted to?
I did. For the most part, I gave them their topics. A few rebelled and kind of came back with their own, and then there were, in the piece of in the instance of the Cassandra Lane essay, another one of my writers who was her professor, writer Mary Dankwa, who wrote about kind of the impact of Michael Jackson's kind of skin bleaching on black people in Ghana.
Yes.
She had Cassandra Lane send me her essay, and I said, oh, this is great. It's got to be in the book.
Right. It is it's a fascinating kaleidoscope of various voices and perspectives. The book, again, is called Everything But the Burden, What White People Are Taking from Black Culture. Greg Tate has edited it. The book is published by Broadway Books. Greg Tate, really interesting to talk with you and very interesting to read this book. I thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have just a couple of minutes left in the program today, so I think we'll spend that time acknowledging the birthday of one of history's most renowned composers. It was on this date, the 1st of March, back in 1810, that the great Polish composer and virtuoso concert pianist Frédéric Chopin was born. An extraordinary child prodigy, Chopin eventually settled in Paris at the age of 21, and there he lived out the remainder of his life until dying in 1849 at the age of 39 from tuberculosis. Chopin was one of the most famous musicians of his day, but oddly enough, he played actually very few public piano recitals. Over the last 18 years of his life, he only played in public, in recital, 30 times. Instead, he much preferred playing in more intimate settings, such as salons and people's homes. And much of the gentle, tender, lyrical music that Chopin composed and loved to play was probably best heard in those kind of settings. Chopin wrote a fair amount of music. Almost all of it was piano. He did write a lovely cello sonata. He wrote a handful of lovely songs as well. We're going to be listening to the most famous of all of Chopin's compositions. It's his Waltz in D-flat major, Opus 64, number 1. It is often mistakenly referred to as the Minute Waltz, as though the pianist is expected to play this piece in 60 seconds. It's actually nicknamed the Minute Waltz or Small Waltz. It's the shortest of all of Chopin's waltzes and justly famous. We will listen to a recording by Alexander Bledovsky. The famous Waltz in D-flat major, the Minute Waltz of Frédéric Chopin, whose birthday we celebrate today.
The Minuet Waltz by Frédéric Chopin, played by Alexander Brailovsky. Tomorrow on the morning show, I'm very excited to welcome into our studios a brilliant young violist originally from Kenosha by the name of David Mason. He is on the campus of the University of Wisconsin-Parkside this week as the Howard Brown Artist in Residence there. And he's going to be playing a special performance at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside this coming weekend. We will have him in our studios. And along with Alvaro Garcia, who, of course, is the orchestra director at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. We look forward to that very much. On Thursday's morning show, I'll be speaking with David Robson, a British science writer who has written a very interesting book called The Expectation Effect, a scientifically sound examination of how our expectations can have very tangible impact on our health,